This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib, coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Seven staff members for the Christian humanitarian aid organization Samaritan's Purse were released from detention Tuesday in South Sudan's famine-stricken area of Mayandit.
That's VOA's Jill Craig reporting from Nairobi. Details coming up.
Also, the UN warns the humanitarian crisis in Somalia continues to deteriorate, and Burundi has declared a malaria epidemic in the country.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, 5,000 doctors at Kenya's public hospitals have finally ended their strike after 100 days. They've signed an agreement with the government that calls for addressing pay and infrastructure issues. The Associated Press reports that during the strike, dozens of people died due to a lack of medical care. President Kenyatta had threatened to fire the doctors if they did not return to work. The doctors also say there is a shortage of public hospital physicians in Kenya.
A U.S.-based charity group says aid workers that were held by armed personnel in Unity State in South Sudan have been released and flown to a safe location from Nairobi. VOA's Jill Craig has more.
Seven staff members for the Christian humanitarian aid organization Samaritan's Purse were released from detention Tuesday in South Sudan's famine-stricken area of Mayandit. Samaritan's Purse Vice President of Programs and Government Relations, Ken Isaacs, says they were arrested by local officials Monday.
So I think there was some local dynamic involved, and we don't have all of those details right now. But what I can tell you very happily is that all of the staff have been released and they're safe. That bit we know. So they have been released.
Isaacs says opposition forces and those loyal to the government warned his organization 2 weeks ago they were preparing to fight. So Samaritan's Purse evacuated between 12 and 15 foreign and South Sudanese aid workers who were not from Mayandit at that time. A request for response was not immediately returned from South Sudan's information minister. Isaacs also clarifies that despite prior reports, the situation was a detention and not a kidnapping.
They were clearly held against their will, but we don't see it as a kidnapping. There was no ransom request made on us.
Samaritan's Purse has been working with the World Food Program to distribute food in Mayandit for more than 2 years. And Isaacs says they plan to return.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, we'll go back. But we've got to have, you know, we'll have to work our way through it and talk with the parties involved. We need some assurances that there's going to be civil behavior. And this war and this factionalism, this tribalism that's going on in South Sudan is incredibly destructive. That there is going to be no winners. There's only going to be more losers and more suffering and more death.
The United Nations and the government of South Sudan say famine in two counties of Unity State, Mayandit and Leer, is affecting more than 100,000 people and has warned that it could spread further. Roughly half of South Sudan's population is projected to be severely food insecure by July. South Sudan's government recently stated it would increase the work permit fee from $100 to $10,000 for each foreign aid worker. South Sudan has become Africa's biggest migrant crisis, as an estimated 1.5 million people have fled to neighboring countries. Tens of thousands of people have been killed since civil war broke out in December 2013. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
The UN warns the humanitarian crisis in Somalia continues to get worse. It reports malnutrition and drought-related disease outbreaks have increased, while acute watery diarrhea and cholera have now spread to 11 of 18 regions. More than 250,000 people have been displaced by drought since November of last year. The UN says about half the population, more than 6 million people, are acutely food insecure. That means they have faced a sudden lack of food or are less able to produce or access the minimum food requirements.
It appears Somali pirates may have launched their first attack Since 2012, suspected pirates boarded a tanker yesterday and forced its Sri Lankan crew to change course and steer towards the northeastern Somali coast. AFP reports the Aris 13 is a ship operated by a company based in the United Arab Emirates. It has 8 crew members. The tanker is carrying fuel from Djibouti and was hijacked en route to Mogadishu, about 16 nautical miles off the Somali coast. Meanwhile, security forces in Puntland have been put on alert after the Aris 13 sailed to within 7 miles of Aluha town on the Red Sea. The hijackers told VOA that they are fishermen who are angry at the illegal fishing in Somali waters. One of the hijackers, who refused to give his name, told VOA Somali Service that they are not going to harm the crew, but they say they want compensation for lost fishing.
Burundi has declared a malaria epidemic in the country as the number of cases and deaths continue to rise. Moses Habayarimana has the story.
The Burundi government says there have been more than 9 million malaria-related cases recorded since January last year. According to the Burundi Health Minister, Josiane Nijimbere, more than 3,700 people have died from malaria since 2016.
Le ministère de la Santé publique et de la lutte contre le sida confirme aujourd'hui.
She says the Ministry of Health confirms today that Burundi is facing an epidemic of malaria. Josiane says from the beginning of this year, more than 1 million malaria-related cases were recorded. The government says there has been a 13% increase in malaria cases compared to last year. The northern provinces of Kirundo, Muyinga, Chankuzo and Kayanza have been the most affected by the disease. Dr. Walter Kazadi is the World Health Organization representative in Burundi.
You know, the malaria epidemics are multifactorial. There might be climatic factors, and you know, Burundi has been affected by El Nino with rising temperatures, and she mentioned it actually. Because of the rising temperature, the area in the northern part who are with the rising of the temperature, they became prone.
Kazadi praised Burundi's move to declare the epidemic, as it will help to reduce malaria risks and deaths.
Yeah, the first priority for the World Organization is to work with all the partners and the Minister of Health to finalize that outbreak response plan, and then to engage in resource mobilization. WHO is going to provide the technical support. We are going to deploy specialists, malaria specialists, epidemiologists, entomologists, to boost the response to the malaria outbreak in Burundi.
According to the Burundian government and the World Health Organization, $31 million is needed for the response plan in order to reduce the malaria infection and death rates. Moses Habyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
Mozambique is battling a cholera outbreak. Officials report more than 1,200 people have been infected and at least 2 people have died. AFP reports 4 of Mozambique's 13 provinces have been affected since the outbreak spread from the capital Maputo in early January. The outbreak has spread to Titi province, which borders Zimbabwe and Malawi.
For many Africans, justice remains elusive. That's the finding of a new Afrobarometer survey conducted in 36 countries. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The survey calls the findings sobering. It says that substantial barriers still inhibit citizens' access to justice. Afrobarometer Deputy Director Carolyn Logan is the author of the report.
Overall, people have a strong belief in the court system, the legitimacy of the court system, and solidly back it. But in terms of their actual perspectives on its reliability and trustworthiness and on the problems they encounter when they do engage with it, there were some significant issues.
The associate professor of political science at Michigan State University says there's a lot of distrust of the justice systems in Africa.
Roughly 43% of people said that they don't have a high level of trust in the court systems, and about 1 in 3 people believes that judges or magistrates are corrupt. Those are findings in the public at large.
The survey details the main complaints of those who've had problems seeking justice.
Large proportions experience a variety of problems. The most prevalent is long delays in seeing their cases through the system. But nearly half said that they had problems understanding legal procedures. And about 1 in 4 said that they couldn't obtain legal counsel, that judges didn't listen to them, or that they were unable to pay court costs.
Logan says some had worse experiences than others.
We found that people who were poor, less educated, and rural tended to experience all of these problems at significantly higher rates than people who were more educated, wealthier, or urban.
The Afrobarometer survey indicates why countries may fail to have adequate judicial systems.
Post-conflict environments tend to face very high challenges in terms of rebuilding judicial systems, and we've seen that some of the countries that perform most poorly here are a couple of the post-conflict countries like Liberia and Sierra Leone, where you tend to have both very high caseload and a decapacitated judicial system. But some of the other types of problems encountered are relating to transparency and accountability in the justice system.
The survey says that even the best-performing countries have substantial work to do before they can meet UN Sustainable Development Goal number 16. It calls for access to justice for all.
We see a wide range of performance across countries. There's some countries that perform pretty well. Botswana, Cape Verde, Lesotho are the best performers, and Southern Africa in general tends to perform better. But there's no country where there isn't some significant room for improvement still in terms of the level of confidence in the judicial system, the frequency with which people experience problems.
Logan says there needs to be greater accountability, transparency, and response to the needs of the people. The African nations doing the best job of providing access to justice usually are those rated higher in their levels of democracy and good governance. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
17 past the hour, you were listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Zimbabwe is facing more financial problems, this time in the mining industry. Reuters reports Zimbabwe's mining output is at risk because banks have been slow to process foreign payments. That's due to a shortage of U.S. dollars. The government has issued bond notes to gradually replace them. The mining industry provides more than half of the country's foreign exchange, but it needs to import machinery, explosives, and chemicals, and sellers offer discounts if payments are made with U.S. dollars. Reuters says importers are having difficulty paying for foreign goods because local bank accounts have little or no foreign currency. Payments have been delayed up to 12 weeks.
President Trump signed a revised executive order earlier this month that will impose a 90-day ban on new visas for citizens of 6 majority Muslim countries. It takes effect on March 16th. The executive order, called Protecting the Nation from Foreign Terrorist Entry into the United States, applies to Iran, Somalia, Sudan, Libya, Syria, and Yemen. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson called the revised order a vital measure for strengthening our national security. However, one Somali-American activist says it could drown out the voices of thousands of immigrants who are contributing to American life. Muhammad Ali is founder and executive director of Iftin Foundation. It supports young Somalis and others from conflict-ridden regions who want to start their own enterprises. Ali also leads the Center for Peace and Social Innovation at Benadir University in Mogadishu. He spoke with me about the challenges he faced as a young refugee in the United States and offered alternative solutions to President Trump's travel ban.
I left Somalia along with my family because of the civil war, And when we first came to the U.S., it was challenging, but the community that we moved into in Columbus, Ohio, was very welcoming. We really felt welcomed and became Americans. I went to high school in the U.S. I went to undergrad, to law school. So I'm very much a product of American education and American culture.
What were some of the biggest challenges for you?
Moving to the U.S., not speaking English, just speaking Somali and not knowing the culture. I think that was the biggest challenge. And really, one of the biggest challenges was getting acclimated to the culture and slowly but surely integrating into the community. And I believe that's what the biggest challenge with this order is. It essentially tells people who've spent years growing up in the U.S. who are now becoming American citizens that you're not really American, that we don't consider you part of our culture.
As a person who's experienced being a refugee here in the United States, as well as becoming recently a U.S. citizen, what are some solutions that you would like to see put into place?
A few years ago, I started an organization called IFKIN Foundation, and we work with youth both in the U.S. and Somalia to help them start their own businesses. And one of the things that we do is we developed our programs in order to prevent young people from becoming radicalized and joining groups like ISIS or Al-Shabaab. And what this order really does is that it marginalizes and isolates a lot of these young people, a lot of these immigrant communities. And through my work, I found that identity really plays an important role. Essentially, organizations like ISIS tell these young people that you're not really part of American culture, you're not really part of American society. And this executive order reinforces that narrative. And when you're looking at abroad, the narrative is Islam versus the West. And a lot of these organizations use that story as a recruitment tool. It's not making America safer. It makes my work that much harder. And the work of a lot of people that are now living abroad who grew up in the U.S. and that are doing really great work in promoting American ideals and American culture and American values abroad.
What are some examples to really help refugees and immigrants become acclimated with a new country?
Well, one of the things that we do is we facilitate partnerships between the immigrant communities and the host communities. So we create a network of people that have lived in those communities for years and connect them with young people who want to start up their own businesses, that are looking for jobs, that are looking for schools, and essentially creating very strong linkages between refugees who've just recently come into the country and people who are living in these communities. And I think that's really what's lost in this executive order and the narrative about refugees. It's that they've really worked with local communities hand in hand.
So what then would you offer as an alternative?
I think it's important to understand that this executive order is predicated on the false premise that A, refugees pose a danger and pose a terrorist threat, and B, that our immigration system does not have the checks or the methodologies in place to do background checks on these immigrants. I mean, I myself spent 18 years getting my American citizenship, and those years involved several background checks, doing several interviews. And a lot of these people living in these refugee communities, they're at greater risk of being the recipients of hate crimes than they are in carrying out attacks themselves. And so I think it's really important to understand that. And it's really important to counter this narrative and really support initiatives and programs and community organizations that work in helping integrate these immigrant communities.
That was Somali-American human rights activist Muhammad Ali. He spoke with me from Nairobi, Kenya.
A Pan-African group promoting justice has raised concerns over the worsening human rights situation in the English-speaking parts of Cameroon. The government recently carried out a major security crackdown targeting protesters following a strike by teachers and lawyers in the region. From the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, Ruben Chama reports.
The group calling itself Africans Rising recently conducted a week-long fact-finding mission to Cameroon. It found that the government of the bilingual Central African nation was muzzling the media and had cut off the English-speaking region from the internet. Moses Isoba, the movement's deputy director, says the four-person delegation met with a range of stakeholders, including activists, trade unionists, religious leaders, lawyers, and youth from the affected areas.
We had a number of meetings with the civil society organizations, We held a number of meetings with the church people. We were able to talk to some Catholic bishops. And while in Yaounde, we talked to the Cameroon Human Rights Commission, which is a government agency. In terms of response to why there is this crisis, one, of course, the government would bluntly say, no, we are dealing with criminals. We are dealing with people that are lawless. That's the narrative as presented when you talk to the people of, you know, in government.
According to Africans Rising, President Paul Biya's government aims at strangling a protest movement by a segment of the Anglophone population that feels it is being politically and economically sidelined by the French-speaking majority. Isoba is a Ugandan who has been involved in development issues for more than 20 years. He says the government has also imposed an internet blockade on the English-speaking regions of southwest and northwest Cameroon, where residents claim they have been discriminated against since independence in 1961.
Why the blockage of internet? This is actually put to the telecom service providers, and weren't able to meet any of the telecom service providers. Been in place since January, then perhaps government should have actually, you know, paid attention and addressed this appropriately.
The internet blockade, which was instituted in January, remains in effect. Together with militarized security operations, this has produced a pervasive climate of repression, fear, and intimidation across the southwest and northwest regions. Protests began in November last year in the northwestern town of Bamenda when lawyers and teachers went on strike, claiming that their rights were being neglected by Cameroon's French-speaking majority. Hundreds of people were arrested and one person killed in the ensuing turmoil. Ezra Bogori is an associate member of the Pan-African movement. He says the repressive response has shrunken the undermined citizen rights to freedom of expression, assembly, and political association.
In order to resolve this deepening crisis, the Africans Rising Mission recommends that the government immediately act to end the repressive actions and fear by ending its militarized security operations in the Anglophone regions with immediate effect. Other recommendations include the immediate and conditional release of all people, including children, civil society leaders, and journalists, the immediate restoration of internet access, the resumption of schooling and establishment of an open, independently mediated dialogue process between government and Anglophone civil society to address all grievances.
Both French and English are official languages in Cameroon, but many in the two English-speaking regions claim they have been discriminated against since independence in 1961, for instance, in education and judicial system. Human rights activists are calling for NGOs and other groups to step up their efforts in addressing the crisis, as Mbogori explains.
As an emerging movement of people and formations working for peace, justice, and dignity, we call on African organizations such as the African Union, as well as other solidarity social justice groupings, to engage this crisis in order to help bring about lasting, peaceful, and justice solutions for the people of the Cameroon.
French is spoken in 8 of Cameroon's 10 regions and English in the northwestern and southwestern regions. In his end-of-year address to the nation, Cameroon's President Paul Biya dismissed calls for cessation, saying the country would remain united. Biya, in power since 1982, is one of Africa's longest-serving presidents. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to The Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
on the next Straight Talk Africa. We look at Ghana, 60 years after becoming the first Black African country to gain independence. The 1957 precedent inspired other nations to seek their sovereignty, and 17 African countries gained independence in 1960. That's right here on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.